It is painful going through this material so quickly. We could easily do the death of the Messiah as a 12-week series, but we need to move on. So, welcome back, everyone. We pick up now where we left off, and I would like to move over to Matthew 27 at verse 32. Matthew 27, verse 32. Notice that I'm jumping around, piecing the story together, and there are big chunks of it that I'm not covering, in part because we know the story pretty well, but I want to create the continuous narrative as we go, and we simply don't have time to cover all of it in just a brief 2-hour period. But Matthew 27, verse 32, so as they took Jesus out to crucify him, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. Simon of Cyrene. Cyrene is in northern Africa, Libya of today, and it's about, I would guess, close to 1,000 miles from Jerusalem, 800,000 miles. It's a long way off. And this follows Simon. He and his family, Mrs. Simon and the two boys, went to Jerusalem for Passover. Now, it's a pilgrimage festival, and all Jews who are able would want to go to Jerusalem for the pilgrimage festivals, Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. But if you lived 1,000 miles away in this day, how many times would you actually go to Jerusalem in your life? Well, you'd try to make it at least once. It's sort of like in Islam. You make a Hajj at least once in your life and go to Mecca if you're able. If you live in Saudi Arabia, you can go often. But if you live in, Santa Monica, you might go once in your life. So I imagine Simon of Cyrene, this was a big event for Simon and his family. And they went all the way to Jerusalem, big crowd of people. They were very happy. They were on vacation. And they were very happy to be there. It was a holy time, and they were doing what everyone else does in Jerusalem. They were shopping, and they were in the old city, and they were buying souvenirs, and there they were. They take Jesus from the Antonia Fortress, and they're moving him to the place of crucifixion. If you've been to Jerusalem, and you've followed the way of the cross, or the stations of the cross, it's not very far. It's like walking from here, down to the 3rd Street Promenade, if that. It's not a long way off. Everything in Israel is small. But you begin from where the Antonia Fortress is, and you start downhill. And you walk downhill, I'd say as far as to the front street here, and then turn left. So the downhill stops, goes left, and then it's flat for a while, and then it begins going back uphill. But on the way down, by the time Jesus got to the bottom of the hill, which again is only from here out to the front street, he collapses under the weight of the cross. He's a big, strong man. He was a carpet construction worker. He was the kind of man that other men were drawn to for leadership. He was the kind of man that women were drawn to for protection. He was the kind of man that children were drawn to because of his strength and his good humor and his kindness. He was not a consumptive, emaciated Victorian figure that we often see in paintings. He was a big, strong person. But remember, he has been beaten nearly to death. He's already in hypovolemic shock, and now he's carrying the cross. The cross would not have been our stylized cross that we see, in the church here. It would have been, the upright would have been permanently fixed at the place of crucifixion. Because when you nail a person to it, they're going to be moving around for sure, and it can't fall over. It's a permanently erected place of execution, and it would have been more than likely an 8x8 timber planted firmly and deeply in the ground as an upright. What he would have carried is the crossbeam, one chunk of 8x8 timber, perhaps 5 to 6 feet long. If you go down to the lumber yard and you find one of those and lift it up, It's well over 100 pounds. They're heavy. I actually went down to Anawalt Lumber and looked at one and tried to pick it up. I could pick it up, but it was an effort to get it up onto your shoulder. That's what he's carrying, the crossbeam. And as he's walking, he's dizzy, he's in shock, and by the time he gets to the bottom of the hill, he simply collapses and face plants on the pavement. They grab him up, and they get him back on his feet and keep him moving. As he's moving, he falls again. He cannot do this. He falls again. They look in the crowd, and there are big crowds of people in the old city at Passover, and they look for the biggest man around. They spot him in the crowd. He's a head taller than everybody else, and there he is with his wife and children, and the Roman guards say, "You, over here." "Me?" "Yes, you." And Simon comes through the crowd. "Get him up." Simon reaches down and takes hold of the crossbeam, gets it off of Jesus because it's now across his back and neck and head as he's on the ground. He picks up the crossbeam onto one shoulder, scoops up Jesus and lifts him up and is holding Jesus up as he staggers toward the cross with Simon carrying the crossbeam on one shoulder and supporting Jesus with the other arm as they make their way. Think of that. And think of Mrs. Simon of Cyrene and the two boys, Alexander and Rufus. They're named elsewhere. Alexander and Rufus, the two little boys. Think of that. There's this horrible scene going on. Their dad is called to help this man, and off he goes. Well, you have no idea where they're taking him, so you follow. You, Mrs. Simon, follow along with the two boys in tow, and you follow where they're going. So Simon carried the cross and Jesus. They came to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided his clothes by casting lots. Notice the crucifixion takes place between the verses. We don't get, as we did in the Passion of the Christ, a graphic image of the actual crucifixion. But what they would have done is Simon got him to the place of crucifixion, the upright, the place of public execution. There were two other crosses, and I would imagine several more crosses that would have been used with some degree of regularity. And Simon dropped the crossbeam and then lowered Jesus to the ground. At that point, Simon of Cyrene would have been literally covered in the blood of Christ. Think of that. And Mrs. Simon watching the horror of this scene and the two boys. They lift Jesus. They strip him naked. Crucifixion occurs naked. That's part of the humiliation of crucifixion. And they would have lifted his shoulders onto that crossbeam and then nailed him through the wrists, not the hands. If you had nails through the palms, your body weight would tear the soft tissue. It would be between the bones in your wrist with long nails, a good 8 inches long, pointy, and then tapering upward toward a large head. They would nail him onto that crossbeam. Then they would lift the crossbeam with him on it up, and they would place it either across the top like a T or perhaps with a metal bracket on the back and slip it down over the upright so it wouldn't come loose. It would drop a good 18 inches to 2 feet and come to a sudden stop with a peg sticking out of the back. That happening, his legs not yet nailed, when they drop the crossbeam down the upright and it comes to a sudden stop, it dislocates both shoulders. It just pulls them right out. If you've ever had a dislocated shoulder, you know what it feels like. Imagine that happening. Now your entire body weight is dangling from two dislocated shoulders. They would then lift your legs not on a little platform, like in a stylized fashion, but bend your legs upward and drive a nail through the heel bone on the side and into the side of the cross. How do you know? Well, in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, they discovered some time ago now, back in the 80s, I believe, the bones of a crucified man. After crucifixion, you're buried. The burial is for the body to decompose. And then the bones are placed in an ossuary, a limestone box, a bone box. And that would be placed in the tomb. Well, apparently, when they crucified this man, nobody knows who he was, but when they crucified him, they drove the nail through the heel bones into the cross, the upright, and the nail hit a knot in the wood and bent the tip of the nail. So after he died and they took him off the cross, they pulled the nail out of the wood, but they couldn't get it back through the bone, so they simply left it in the heel bone. That heel bone with the nail, a replica of it, is on display in the Israel Museum. The actual bone with the nail was placed back in the ossuary and buried. Because in Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, you don't desecrate a body like that. So they made a molding of the heel bone and the nail, and it's on display in the Israel Museum. And there's a whole section of explanation about how crucifixion was done in that day. I don't think they were particular about it. It could have been done one way or another way, but that was the most common way. And what would happen, given that your shoulders were dislocated and your heels were nailed to the sides of that upright and your legs bent, you would have to stand up on the two nails in order to breathe, take a breath. And then you would slouch back down. And then you would have to stand up again to breathe again. And you simply did that over and over and over again until you could no longer stand up and you would suffocate. So typically it would take 3 to 5 days to die on a cross. Jesus died in 6 hours. Why? Because he had been beaten nearly to death before he ever got there. He was already in hypovolemic shock when he was nailed to that cross from massive blood loss and fluid loss. So they nail him to the cross. And then we read in Matthew 27, verse 36, after sitting down, they kept watch over him. Above his head, they placed the written charge against him. This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Two robbers, the Greek word is leiste, it means robber in the sense of one who steals authority. They were insurrectionists. They're usurping the authority of the Roman Empire. They're not thieves or robbers like someone who pickpockets you. That's not a capital offense under Roman law. Treason and insurrection are. So these are the two who are with Barabbas who took part in the insurrection, the rebellion, and they were crucified on either side. For the first 3 hours on the cross, humanity sank to its lowest point. People walked by. The cross was not up on a pastoral hilltop. It was right on the main thoroughfare, right on the main street. More than likely outside the Damascus Gate today. It's the busiest roadway. And in Jesus' day, the Damascus Gate was there because that was the road up to Damascus, to make your way up to Damascus. It was the main thoroughfare for people traveling. And the whole point of crucifixion was humiliation and extreme agony. And the lesson was, if you fool around with the Roman Empire, this will happen to you. The crucifixion would have been on the main thoroughfare. And the person crucified would be just a little bit above eye level, not way up in the air, but right where you can look him in the eye. His feet may be 18 inches off the ground on that cross. So people would walk by. He's totally naked, and people mocked him. They ridiculed him. They spit on him. Humanity sank to its lowest point. When Jesus was on that cross, what was he thinking? What was in his mind? If we turn back to Psalm 22, at the beginning of class, I referenced Psalm 22 in my Psalms, The Journey Through the Poetry of Experience, where I analyze Psalm 22 as a poem and then have a full lecture on Psalm 22. Jesus knew the Psalms intimately. He knew good portions of the scripture intimately. He quotes regularly from Daniel. He quotes from the Psalms. He knows these texts. And Psalm 22 is a psalm attributed to David. It's one of 73 Davidic psalms. And David was king from 1010 to 970 BC, 1,000 years before Jesus. David writes Psalm 22, and it has its context within David's life. But Jesus knew this psalm intimately. And when he's on the cross, imagine the agony of that experience. Imagine the waves of pain, and imagine him in a condition of shock, drifting in and out, and reality spinning about and tipping, and the distortion of reality when you're in that condition. And as he's in that condition and looking about, Psalm 22 is playing in his mind. Listen to it. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh, my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, and I'm not silent. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the praise of Israel. In you our fathers put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. They cried to you, you were saved. In you they trusted and were not disappointed. But me, I am a worm, not a man, scorned by men and despised by the people. He sees people walking past as his reality is distorting and turning, and people mocking him, and voices shouting at him, and people spitting at him. I am a worm, scorned by men and despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast upon you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me. Trouble is near. There is no one to help me. And he looks at the Roman soldiers watching. Many bulls surround me, strong bulls of Bashan encircle me, roaring lions tearing their prey, open their mouths wide against me. He looks down at his body, drenched in sweat and blood. I am poured out like water. He looks at his shoulders, disjointed. All my bones are out of joint. What happens when you lose all that bodily fluid? Your circulatory system is a closed system. When it suddenly becomes open, your heart beats faster and faster to keep moving what little fluid there is through you. Your heart is racing. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue cleaves to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. The Roman soldiers, and quite literally with all the blood loss at the cross, dogs in the Middle East are negative things. Dogs are scavengers. They run in packs, and you can scare them off with a stick. Dogs are, well, it's the greatest insult you can make to a Middle Eastern man, to call him a dog. Dogs are not domesticated lap pets in the Middle East. Dogs have surrounded me, a pack of dogs lapping up the blood. A band of evil men has encircled me. He looks at his hands, at his feet. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. This psalm is so vivid to him, it's so well known, that in this horrible condition, it's running through his mind like a song you can't forget. And he looks and he sees it all taking place before him. It's a horror, the image of utter horror. Back in Matthew 27 at verse 45, from the sixth hour till the ninth, from noon to three, darkness came over all the land. We see his suffering in rather graphic terms in the first 3 hours. But in the second 3 hours, at verse 45, it's as if God drops a mantle of darkness over the cross, and we're not permitted to watch. In the second half, hours 3 through 6, the transaction between the Father and the Son takes place. Jesus suffered incredibly on that cross, but in the second phase, he pays the penalty for every sin of every person who has ever lived, is living, or will live before a holy and righteous God. The transaction between the Father and the Son takes place. And if we thought his physical suffering and mental anguish were horrible, and they are, it is nothing compared to this second phase where that transaction takes place. We can be with him in eternity for a million years in the presence of Christ and the beatific vision of God for a million years, and we will never even begin to fathom the depth and the blackness of the suffering that he went through to bring us there. Never. In the end, he said, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Echoing verse 1 of Psalm 22. Over in the Gospel according to John, we're told, and John is there at the foot of the cross, remember? Over in John, at chapter 19, verse 28, later, knowing that all was now completed, and so the scripture would be fulfilled. This is John reflecting back over 60 years. John being right there at the foot of the cross. Jesus said, "I'm thirsty." He has had nothing to drink since the meal the night before, and he has lost an enormous amount of body fluid. A jar of wine vinegar was there, so they soaked a sponge in it, put the sponge on a stalk of hyssop, and lifted it to his lips. When he had received the drink, Jesus said, "It is finished." Better, it is accomplished. The task I was given by God the Father has been accomplished. It is done. And with that, says John, he didn't die. He bowed his head and gave up his spirit. He is in control right to the very end. Now, John tells us, and only John tells us this, it was the day of preparation, and the next day was a special Sabbath because the Jews did not want the bodies left on the crosses during the Sabbath. They asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man, the one on either side. Why break the legs? Remember how crucifixion works? You have to be able to stand up on the two nails so you can breathe. If you take a baseball bat, whack it across their shins and break their legs, they can't stand up and they simply suffocate very quickly. But they came to Jesus and they found he was already dead. They did not break his legs. John, thinking back over 60 years of reflecting upon this, said that was done to fulfill scripture that not one of his bones would be broken. That's in Exodus 12, verse 46. But John tells us when they came to Jesus, they found he was already dead. They didn't break his legs. Instead, one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing forth a sudden flow of blood and water. So one of the Roman soldiers with a spear simply inserts the spear between two ribs and pierces his heart. A sudden flow of blood and water came forth. That tells us two things. Number one, the spear pierce the pericardium and then the heart. So both water and blood came out very quickly. It also tells us something about what's going on here. I have a very good colleague who teaches for Logos Bible Study, Rabbi Michael Marison. Michael has taught with me for the past 7 or 8 years. He's a Jewish rabbi and does a number of very good classes. One class that he does, well, several classes. One is called The Judaism That Jesus Knew and Practiced. Another is called Why the Jews Rejected Jesus as the Messiah. Really good course. And the third that I bring up here is a course that he does titled Blood, Water, and Redemption. In the Bible, from the very, very beginning, the archetypical act of salvation, I'm sorry, of redemption, and I use redemption specifically, the archetypical act of redemption is God bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. The Israelites start out where they belong, in an intimate covenant relationship with God. They move away and become slaves in Egypt, and God, in his own time, steps in and brings them out of Egypt back into a proper relationship with him. Redemption is something starting out where it belongs, going to where it doesn't belong, and bringing it back to where it does. What do we think of? We don't use the word much in a non-religious context, but think of S&H green stamps. Remember those? When you went to the store and you bought something or you bought gas, they gave you green stamps. You brought them home. You stuck them in a kitchen drawer. Once a month, all the kids sat around the table gluing them into books. You had a catalog. And when you had enough books, you drove out to the S&H Redemption Center. Remember? You took the stamps back to where they belong, and they gave you a toaster oven or something else. So redemption is something starting where it belongs, going to where it doesn't belong, and then being brought back to where it does belong. In the archetypical act of redemption, the Exodus, what happens? There is blood on the doorpost over the house of the Israelites. After the Exodus, they pass through the waters of the Red Sea and then into the promised land. It's the archetypical act of redemption. And every time we see an act of redemption in the Bible, it involves blood and water. In fact, over in Hebrews, we read, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. So John is very careful to point out that both blood and water came forth. It's not only empirical evidence that Jesus was, in fact, dead, but it was an act of redemption that took place. John is there. We also read in the Gospels that Jesus, before he died, Mary was at the foot of the cross, and so was John. And he gave Mary to John and John to Mary. And I had always read that as Jesus gave Mary to John to take care of. And that was always the way I read it, until about 3 months ago. You know, every time, I've taught this story 1,000 times, and every time you see something else, and every now and again you have this epiphany, this light bulb comes on, and you go, oh, I never saw that before. We're doing a class on Wednesday morning, a seminar in San Diego at our classroom on the writings attributed to John, the Gospel according to John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and Revelation. And we've been on John for a year and a half. And it's a really in-depth, you know, we'll cover 10 verses in 2 hours. And it's an in-depth discussion and kind of graduate school seminar format. And I was teaching this chapter, John 19, and Jesus said, Mother, here is your son, and here is your mother. I don't think he was giving Mary to John to take care of at all. I think he was giving John to Mary. John is the inner circle is the 12. But the inner circle that we saw at the Transfiguration, Peter, James, John. James and John are the brothers. And Peter and his brother Andrew and the two James and John and their father are partners in the fishing business. They own a company together. They're a very, very close group of people. And John seems to be, in my reading certainly, seems to be younger than Jesus. The others are roughly the same age, contemporaries, but John seems maybe 10, 12 years younger, almost like a little brother. And Jesus is particularly close to John, particularly close, at the Last Supper. Peter is to Jesus' right, John is to his left. John falls asleep with his head on Jesus' shoulder. There's a real intimacy between them, like a big brother, little brother, in addition to lots of other things. But I think at the foot of the cross, what Jesus is doing is incorporating John into his most intimate family. He's bringing John into the relationship that Jesus himself has with Mary as his mother. And he's making Mary John's mother as well, bringing her into this very, very intimate relationship. I think primarily the gift is to John. And yes, John will take care of her, but I've never seen it from that perspective until quite recently. And it was an epiphany for me. It was like a light bulb came on. Well, Jesus dies on the cross. Verse 38, John 19. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple, but secretly because he feared the Jews. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away. He was accompanied by Nicodemus. Remember from chapter 3, we looked at that chapter carefully and we read the gaps. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea took the body and prepared it for burial. He was placed in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, and it was an unused tomb, brand new. No one had been in it before. So Joseph is a wealthy fellow. He had the tomb made for himself and his family, but it had not yet been used, and that's where Jesus will be put. Not to remain there for who knows how long, but for 1 year. Notice the burial custom. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloe, about 75 pounds. Taking Jesus' body, they washed it and prepared it, and then with the myrrh and aloe, slathered it all over him. It's like a Crisco consistency. They slathered it on his hand. Then they wrapped with linen strips, about 4 inches wide, they wrapped his index finger, then his middle finger with it, then the ring finger, then the little finger, and filled the hand up. They anointed, wrapped, until he had what looked like boxing gloves, right? And then they worked up each arm, his feet, his legs, and then they put him tight together, anointed the whole body again, and then wrapped him from feet to neck in a thick layer of linen cloth, and then anointed his head and wrapped it in one piece of linen cloth. Then they placed him in the tomb. The whole idea was to put the body in the tomb where it would decompose over a one-year period. The period of mourning in Judaism for a person who dies is 1 year. The body would decompose. Then the wrappings would be taken off, all the body fluids absorbed by the linen, and the odor controlled by the myrrh and aloe, and the bones would then be placed in an ossuary, a limestone box, with the name on it, and that box would be placed in the family tomb. So you could have many people there. So we have a brand new tomb, and Jesus is placed in that tomb. That was Friday evening. Chapter 20 of John. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. The tomb was cut into a solid wall of limestone with a circular stone rolled in front of the entrance. It was customary for the family to visit the tomb. The stone would be rolled away. They would enter the tomb into what was called the weeping chamber, where they would pray for the person, and they could re-anoint and continue wrapping the body to absorb the body fluids. So Mary showed up early on the first day of the week, Sunday, and she saw the stone had been removed. Standing at a bit of a distance, the tomb is open. Well, that's odd, because they put the stone in front of it, and they put the stone there so animals wouldn't go in or nothing would happen to the body. The stone's moved. Her immediate thought was someone opened the tomb and took the body. She ran back to the disciples. She came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved, John, and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb. Someone has stolen the body. We don't know where they put him." Peter and the other disciple, John, started for the tomb. Both were running. They both just take off like rabbits for that tomb. Somebody has taken the body. Now remember, John is writing our gospel. And John and Peter run to the tomb. Now I pictured John being 10, 12 years younger than Peter. And it's now, in the gospel according to John, it's the early 90s. John's the last living apostle. Peter dies in AD 68 during the persecution under Nero. And John writes, "Both were running, but the other disciple, John, outran Peter and reached the tomb first." I beat him there. He's going to mention this three times in the story. I got there first. "He," John, "bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there on the floor, but he didn't go in." So John bends over, looks in, and sees the strips of linen. Then Simon Peter, who was behind him, I got there first, you know, arrived and pushed past John and went right into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been around Jesus' head. The cloth was folded up by itself, separate from the linen. It's just a pile of linen strips and a folded up cloth. Finally, the other disciple, John, who, by the way, had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. Now, parenthetically, they still did not understand from the scriptures that Jesus had to rise from the dead. They understood he did, but they didn't link it with the scriptures yet. Now, I need to point out, early on the first day of the week, chapter 20, verse 1, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed. In John's Greek is very, very precise. And the word he uses, the verb, is blepo, B-L-E-P-O, blepo. It's a simple observation of fact. This is a water bottle. No analysis, it's just a simple observation of fact. Blepo. She saw that the tomb had been opened. Then, down in verse 4, both were running, but the other disciple reached the tomb first. He, John, bent over, my translation reads, and looked inside. The Greek is blepo. He saw. A simple observation of fact. He bent over, he saw the strips of linen. Then, at the end of verse 6, Peter arrives. He saw the strips of linen and the burial cloth. Different word now. The word saw there at the second half of verse 6 is thoreo, T-H-O-R-E-O. It means to critically examine. Like, I see. It's a critical examination of the observation of fact. And then over at the end of verse 8, finally the other disciple who had reached the tomb first, John, also went inside. He saw and believed. That word saw is eido, E-I-D-O. It is a sudden realization, an epiphany, an understanding. So we have a sequence of simple observation of fact to critical examination of the fact to, oh, now I get it. So there's a movement across those three words that are very carefully placed by John. Well, Jesus is gone from the tomb. Now the only thing left is Peter. I mentioned last hour that after Peter leaves the home of Caiaphas, runs down the street and collapses in a heap, that we see him, but we never hear from him. We read in John 21, and John knows this. At the end of chapter 20, John writes a conclusion. He says in chapter 20, verse 30, Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. Well, there's some in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and other places too. But I'm not telling you, I'm not just recounting the facts. So he did many other things that aren't recorded in this book. But these that I've chosen to record, to write, are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John is not recounting Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John, in light of 60 years of reflecting upon the events, is telling us what they meant to him and should mean to us. The only loose end is Peter, chapter 21. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples up at the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, called Didymus, Nathanael from Cana, the sons of Zebedee, James and John, two other disciples, were together. Peter is back home. He said, I'm going out to fish. What, he's back in the fishing business? No. Peter is devastated at what he has done and at what has happened. Well, they go out to fish. They catch nothing. I'm not sure they even tried. I think Peter was in the boat. He was looking eastward to the Golan Heights, the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Sea of Galilee is about 7 miles wide, 11 miles long. They're halfway out. He's looking at the Golan Heights. It's right after Passover, full moon at Passover. It comes up over the Golan Heights and shines down into Peter's face as he's looking eastward. And when is the last time we saw that? We didn't cover it in this class. But remember, they were out together about halfway out in the lake, and Jesus was on the other side, the Golan Heights side, and it was Passover, and there was a full moon, and a crowd is there, and he wants to avoid the crowd, so he walks across the water. It's the only miracle Jesus performs with no didactic or moral or ethical purpose. He simply wants to get from point A to point B and not encounter that 15,000 people waiting for him. So he walks across the water. Peter and the others are in the boat. They're rowing hard back home because the wind is blowing from the west and Jesus is walking toward them from the east. His garments are blowing out behind him and he's backlit by a full moon. What do they see drifting across the water? This ghostly shadowed figure. It's a ghost. Well, when we go to Israel, we visit the Sea of Galilee, we go out on a boat at night, and I try to time our trip. Well, I don't try. I do time our trip on a full moon on that night so we can recreate the scene. And sure enough, if we're out in that boat and we saw a figure drifting across the water, we'd think it was a ghost too. And it is a very funny scene in so many ways. But Peter walks on the water. He does. He gets out of the boat. And I can just see Jesus. You can't see his face because he's shadowed, right? But can't you see Jesus and the disciples in the boat going, this is going to be good, right? And Peter gets out. And he starts walking on the water. And then he realizes what he's doing. Ah! He begins to sink. You don't begin to sink. You drop like a chunk of lead. Choo, down he goes. And Jesus grabs hold of a hand, lifts him up, gets him back in the boat. And he doesn't say, you of little faith. The other disciples in the boat are rolling in laughter. This is a very funny scene. And now Peter is out on the lake at a full moon looking east. Don't you think he's replaying this scene? And the playfulness of it and what Jesus did? He's heartbroken. They're not fishing. Peter's just sitting there remembering things past. And then they come back. They get back in. Jesus said, did you catch any fish? He's about 100 yards. He's on shore. They're about 100 yards off. And we read in the story. And did you catch any fish? No. Throw your nets out. All right. They throw their nets out. They catch a huge amount of fish. Well, Peter gets back in. Jesus has made them breakfast. Again, Peter says nothing. They're sitting around the fire eating fish and bread. And finally, Jesus says, Peter, let's go for a walk. They walk north on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, toward the northern end, not many villages up there. And they have a conversation. Verse 15, when they finished eating, Jesus said to Peter, Simon, son of John, notice how formal. Not Peter. That was the nickname that he gave him. And it was a funny nickname. It was the opposite of what Peter is. No, now it's Simon, son of John. Remember the boast you made when I said you would deny me three times? Even if all the others do, I will never. Do you truly love me more than they do? And Peter replied, yes, Lord, you know I love you. Again, John's word choice is very, very specific. There are several words in Greek for the verb to love. Eros is erotic love. Phileo is friendship or brotherly love, like the city of Philadelphia, city of brotherly love. And agapeo, which is the highest form of love. Jesus said, do you truly love me, agapeo, the kind of love that I called you to, more than they do? And Peter replies, Lord, you know I phileo you. I failed at what you asked me to do, but you know I'm your friend. They went a little further. Simon, son of John, forget about the comparison at verse 16. Do you truly love me? Agapeo. Peter answered again, Lord, you know I phileo you. I'm your friend. I failed at that. You know it and I know it. But you cannot question my friendship. They went further. And Jesus said a third time, verse 17, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And there, Jesus drops to phileo. Are you my friend? It's not that Jesus asked three times because Peter denied him three times. That's rather small. No. Jesus questions even the friendship. At which point, Peter is heartbroken because Jesus asked him the third time, do you phileo me? Are you my friend? He questioned even that. And Peter, with tears welling in his eyes, said, Lord, you know all things. You know I phileo. You know I'm your friend. And Jesus said, in effect, okay, let's start there. In this scene, Jesus forces Peter to confront Peter. It was never an issue of Jesus forgiving Peter. Jesus forgave Peter right away. The issue was Peter forgiving Peter. And he can't do it. Peter cannot forgive himself for what he had done until Jesus takes him on the walk and forces him in a very subtle psychological move to confront his failure and to understand where he is. Only then is Peter able to forgive himself. And only then can he come back and become the leader of the others. We'll see that in our Birth of the Church class starting June 2nd. 2nd or 4th? 4th. June 4th. We'll see what happens after this. 50 days later at the Feast of Pentecost, Jewish Feast of Pentecost, AD 32, the Holy Spirit arrives. Peter stands up on the temple platform and he preaches a fire-breathing sermon on that platform. Oh, Peter's back. But it takes John 21 to get him back. John knows it. 60 years of reflecting upon this event. And John has been following them. And, you know, they turn around. Peter said, what's he doing here? He's been following, right? John knows it's a loose end in our story. And in John 21, he ties up the loose end. We'll pick it up in the Birth of the Church on June 4th. So that brings us right to the end of our portrait of Jesus, a couple minutes after 9. Sorry I ran us over a little bit. But please, this Holy Week, This is Monday night of Holy Week. This is a time to take your experience of the gospel, to take your experience of Christ to an ever deeper level. Knowing Christ, yes, factual information, blepo, factual information. Critically examining that factual information, thoreo, but what we really want is a full experiential comprehension of who Christ is and our relationship with him. And this is the perfect time to focus on that and steep yourself in the experience of the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ as we approach Good Friday, the Holy Triduum, and on to Easter morning. Father, we thank you for all your blessings. We thank you especially for the blessing of being here today, gathered around your word. We thank you for the 5 weeks we've had together, for the gracious hospitality of Monsignor Torgerson and St. Monica's for having us here, for the opportunity to have a close look at who your son is as we see him presented in the Gospels. Well, from one particular point of view, a literary point of view, but it's one point of view that adds a richness, a tone, a texture, and a color to the stories that we're so familiar with. We ask you to please open our minds and hearts that we might come ever closer to your son in this season of Lent and especially during Holy Week. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. And we'll see you in June.